Where Building Bridges, produced by Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg, heard over WBAI 99.5 FM New York and WPFW 89.3 FM in DC, and more than 60 radio stations and over internet radio across the U.S. and Canada.
We're joined by Phyllis Bennis, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C., where she directs IPS's new internationalism project. Her work concerns U.S. foreign policy issues. She serves on the National Board of Jewish Voice for Peace, as well as the board of the Afro-Middle East Center in Johannesburg. And among her numerous articles and many books is Before and After U.S. Foreign Policy and the War on Terrorism.
Amy, great to be with you.
Phyllis, what is your response to President Biden's State of the Union cheerleading for war and saber-rattling in response to Putin's invasion of Ukraine?
Well, on the one hand, it's very dangerous, the sort of cheerleading for the Ukrainian position from a very militarist approach, rather than discussing the urgent necessity of negotiations and diplomacy. It was good that he repeated his commitment not to send troops to fight in Ukraine. It would have been better, of course, if there had been an add-on commitment not to send drones or airstrikes or any other military engagement in the region. The focus has been very much on troops on the ground, which is a decreasing component of U.S. overseas military operations. And I think that the overall question of what will actually help end this crisis, end this war, was left because there wasn't enough discussion about negotiations. There also needed to be an acknowledgement of the role that the U.S. and NATO continue to play. We didn't, of course, hear that, nor did I expect to. But I think that the focus on the urgency of diplomacy, particularly when you're talking about potential conflicts, however unlikely, it's not impossible that this could lead to a nuclear exchange between the world's two largest nuclear weapon states. The urgency of it is very, very extreme.
Phyllis, one of the schisms that is occurring within generally progressive elements within this country, people who have considered themselves to be anti-imperialist, to be anti-war, is that there's a lack of unity of purpose to demanding an immediate ceasefire, to a pullback of Russian troops, and to resolve the controversy by diplomacy, because the issue would seem to be almost, shall we say, a Cuban Missile Crisis, meaning that there is a strong and powerful consideration as to who, quote unquote, fired the first shot. NATO, the provocateur, the expansionist, using Ukraine as its pathway to further threaten and move east towards a threat to the integrity of the Russian state. And that seems to be a primary issue. And for those who justify the activity of Russia, or as one person said to me, history will absolve Russia, they are legitimately going into Ukraine in a self-defensive posture. This is their Cuban Missile Crisis and must be Russia supported. So how do you respond to that panoply of issues and concerns? What is the fundamental question that people who are anti-war must be pursuing at this juncture?
You know, Mimi, history is shaped and identified and to some degree determined by when you start the clock. If you start the clock in 1991, you get one set of answers. in terms of the role of NATO and the role of Ukraine, the role of the new Russia with the new decline of the Soviet Union. If you start the clock in 1994, when promises were made to Ukraine in return for giving up its nuclear weapons, it would be defended by the Russian state and by the United States in terms of its territorial integrity. You get a different position. If you go up to 1998, you get a different one. By 2008, you have NATO promising that Ukraine and Georgia would be welcomed into NATO. But earlier, you had positions by the U.S. and other NATO powers saying that Ukraine would never be joining NATO. So it depends when you start the clock. I think right now we need to start a clock, not the only clock, but we need to start a clock in February of 2022 with this war in Ukraine. It was and remains, in my view, an illegal, unacceptable, criminal act of war. It was not unprovoked, as President Biden claimed to say. There were numerous provocations over the years by the United States, by NATO, by other NATO powers. Those provocations, in my view, do not justify the decision that Putin made to take his army to war. I think that Russia clearly has become, at whatever point we want to identify following the collapse of the Soviet Union, Russia has become an autocratic, right-wing, thuggish state, not a state that I think progressives would be in a position of wanting to support a government, even if we disagreed with certain actions or something like that. But I think the question is, what's happening to people? What's happening to human rights? Those, to me, are the critical questions for determining what our position should be right now. The reality is, we don't have a lot of influence on what Putin does. It's not clear how much influence people in his own country have on what he does, even the people closest to him, even the oligarchs. It's not clear how much influence they have on Putin's decision-making. He is very much autocratic and very much operating in a one-man power environment. But I think while we focus on what our government is doing, what our government is calling for, which I think we should be, it is important, I think, as internationalists, that we stand with people who are facing this horrific new war, people that are being killed in their cities, and where there is a threat of an actual nuclear exchange, a threat that is an enormous one, even though the chances of it, I think, are very, very small. They're not non-existent. And there is no justification, in my view, for supporting an ongoing conflict, an ongoing war that could, by any stretch of the imagination, and unfortunately it doesn't take a huge stretch of imagination to see how that could occur. So I think our obligation is to say unequivocally that this is an illegal war, that the solution to this war is not in sending more weapons to Ukraine, not in sending fighters or jets or bombs to Ukraine, but in focusing on how to get diplomacy underway, that we need diplomacy and not war, but we have to be prepared to go beyond that slogan. You know, diplomacy, not war is a great slogan, but it doesn't get you very far if you can't explain what should the diplomacy be aimed at. In my view, that starts with an immediate ceasefire, a Russian pullback of all their troops and tanks from Ukrainian territory, an agreement that Ukraine will not be entering NATO in any foreseeable future, an agreement to discuss and negotiate neutrality for Ukraine, and then we can move towards broader negotiations around issues of nuclear weapons that the U.S. has stashed across Europe, the issue of conventional weapons in Europe on both the Russian side and the U.S. side. These are all critical questions. Some of these involve treaties that the Trump administration simply walked away from and abandoned that need to be recreated. It's a very, very dangerous, over-armed reality right now in terms of what NATO and Russia have been doing in Europe. And we need new negotiations on that, the New START treaty. All of these are important moves. But the first point of diplomacy is an immediate ceasefire, a Russian pullback, and discussions about Ukraine's future. The Ukrainian president has already said that there could be discussions about neutrality, what that might look like. So there's a basis for diplomacy, and that's what we need to be fighting for.
Let me push a little in the direction of Ukraine. Certainly there is are many individuals who suggest that Ukraine is not quite the hapless football being kicked around by NATO and or Russia, but the fact of it being largely a government that whose military forces are dominated by anti-Russian activists from the period of entities within Ukraine that were Nazi sympathizers who were against certainly the USSR, and that it is primarily a fascist entity or a Nazi, if you want to kind of bifurcate fascism and Nazi, but certainly that is what Putin is saying and many other individuals who we consider on the left.
People are saying a lot of things. And I think it's wrong. I think it's wrong in what Putin says, and I think it's wrong when people on the left or on the right here say that. What is true, unequivocally, is that there are a set of Nazi-related and fascist militias in Ukraine, as there are in this country. And there is at least one in the Ukrainian National Guard, which is what everybody always talks about, the ABOB. Unit. And that's a huge problem for Ukrainians to deal with. It doesn't, in my view, it doesn't, number one, it certainly does not mean that Ukraine is a, quote, fascist country. It also, interestingly, I think, does not mean that it's a fascist government. The election of Zelensky was a specific repudiation of a right-wing government that included some fascist elements. Those fascist elements have not disappeared from Ukrainian society, as far as I know. But they have largely disappeared from government power. Their party is no longer represented in the Ukrainian parliament. The president obviously stands as an anti-fascist, as an anti-Nazi. He's made that clear. And the election, when he came to power, when a new parliament was brought in, also was a repudiation of that. So I think it's really sloppy thinking. And I think it's driven by ideological rigidity, if you will, on many sides, not only on the left, but also on the right, making this judgment that Ukraine is a somehow fascist country. What we're seeing right now is a country, it's not just a political football. I don't know anybody who's saying that. It is a border country that has been used and attacked on all sides, certainly by NATO, certainly by Russia, certainly by the Soviet Union before that. You know, this is a long and complicated history between what is now the state of Russia and what is now the state of Ukraine. When we look at the long history of both, they go way back before the rise of nation states. So, you know, the notion that Ukraine was or wasn't an independent state in whatever year you want to pick, 1850 or 1790 or whatever, of course it wasn't. There were no nation states at that time in the way that we understand modern nation states now. But this notion that we can dismiss any human rights violations, any crimes against humanity, any war crimes against Ukraine, because there is a unit of fascists in their military, I think really distorts our notion, among other things, of humanity. You know, these are people in their country that are being attacked and destroyed. Now, does the U.S. bear some responsibility for the situation that led to this? Absolutely. And for those of us who have participated in protests all around the world against NATO, demanding no to NATO, an end to NATO, which started back in 1991 with the end of the Cold War, our work is not over. We need to continue that work. But that doesn't say anything about the urgency, the emergency that is now underway in Ukraine. And this is a brutal war of aggression, in my view, that as internationalists, we should be standing for an end to that war on an immediate, urgent basis, calling for an immediate ceasefire and a withdrawal of the invading troops.
You've certainly referenced NATO. One of the other things that is happening is, in fact, there are troops being ordered in by the tens of thousands to Poland. There's a brand new military base in Poland that is being constructed as we speak, just 100 miles from the Russian border. There are tens of millions of dollars that are now being asked, whether that is for the use of drones or the secreting of weapons into Ukraine and so on. So within the idea of diplomacy and the context of demanding an immediate ceasefire, what is and how must be the response to the U.S. peace forces based on the kind of saber rattling, the cheerleading for war, and issues such as, indeed, building a brand new military base in Poland?
Well, you know, Mimi, I wrote about that base in my article last Friday.
Indeed.
About what was going on in Ukraine. And I got the information from the New York Times. The problem is none of us, and I include myself in that, none of us had paid attention when that base was first, when the news of it sort of went public in the mainstream media. We didn't respond. There wasn't a huge mobilization against it. There should have been. One of the consequences of this war is a vast escalation in military spending here in the U.S., which is our huge responsibility, and unfortunately in countries all around the world. Germany, which had really resisted sending troops abroad, being willing to allow the European Union to sell arms to any side in any conflict zone. They had had a very strong position against all of that since World War II. Germany has now completely flip-flopped. In the Bundestag, they just voted to escalate their military spending to the 2% of GDP goal set by NATO. That's a disaster. It's a disaster for Germany. It's a disaster for the peace movement there. It's a disaster for Europe. It's a disaster for the world. Japan is considering a major escalation in their military budget. Our job here in the U.S. absolutely has to include demanding a cut in military spending. We should be starting with a 50% cut. 50% of our military budget right now goes directly to U.S. military corporations, to McDonnell Douglas and to Raytheon and to all these corporations that are producing weapons for these wars, for NATO, for other wars. That's our job, to be demanding that. My colleagues at IPS, who run the National Priorities Project, for those of listeners who aren't familiar with it, it's a great resource, a great website that can tell you exactly what U.S. military budget comes from in terms of our taxes. And in your city, your town, your county, your congressional district, how much money every year is spent on the military budget and what it could be used for if that money stayed at home, in terms of Medicare for all and a Green New Deal and jobs and education and all those questions. So we have a huge amount of work to do. This war is making all of that worse. It's legitimizing in too many minds the notion that somehow more military spending is somehow needed. You know, we're spending, it will be close to $800 billion this year. $800 billion. It's such a huge amount, it's almost incomprehensible.
Phyllis Bennis, your response also, before we get into what diplomacy would look like and what the demands might be that take us to that point of actually initiating diplomacy as a resolution to the conflict. The issue of sanctions, parse those out for us. They, of course, look very clinical on their face, and they would seem to be an alternative to the militarism, the bloodshed. But indeed, we've certainly understood now that sanctions most often fall against the peoples of a country, such as in Venezuela.
Absolutely.
And other areas, and are life-destroying.
Sanctions should no longer be viewed, if they ever were, and they are, unfortunately, but should not be viewed as an alternative to war. Sanctions are an act of war. There's a reason, for instance, that in the UN Charter, sanctions are included in Chapter 7, which is the chapter that deals with armed force. not in Chapter 6, which deals with peaceful methods, peaceful means of dealing with conflict. They're seen as an aggressive act and are often illegal. The economic broad sanctions that we saw at such horrific use in Iraq, for instance, in an entire decade from the 1991 war against Iraq right up until the invasion of Iraq in 2003, the sanctions there were responsible for the deaths of well over a million people, 500,000 children under the age of five, just that. It's a shocking thing what sanctions can do. They can often kill far more people than bombs and bullets in any war situation. The question of sanctions is often the easy answer for members of parliaments, for government leaders, for the media to say, well, we're not going to go to war, but we'll impose sanctions. This time around, U.S. officials, the mainstream media, are all talking about explicitly having the goal of crippling, that's the common word this round, crippling the Russian economy. That means crippling the economy of 140 million Russians, ordinary people, who have no influence on what Putin is doing in Ukraine with the military. So the question of sanctions, I think, has to be very much on our agenda. We should be calling for an absolute end to the kinds of sanctions that are affecting the entire population. The removal of Russian banks from the SWIFT system, for instance, which is the international system for banks to be able to do currency exchanges and exchange of funds. Without that, it may well affect parts of the Russian government, although I'm guessing that they have been well protected because they've been expecting this. But ordinary Russians who work for a company who will no longer be able to use the international system to buy parts, for instance, or to pay bills, they are going to be affected immediately. People are already unable to get money out of ATM machines in parts of Russia because of the collapse. The level of inflation has gone up to 30% already, and this is just in the first few days. So it's a very, very slippery slope to affecting the whole population. The individual sanctions that might be imposed on individual billionaire oligarchs, I don't have a problem with that particularly. I think the key is it's not going to do much good. It's not going to really affect Putin's decision-making, because it's been clear for a while that he has kept the oligarchs out of any positions of influence and power on political decision-making. So that may hurt some billionaires. That's fine, but that's not going to bring this war to a close or force diplomacy anytime soon. So these kinds of sanctions, the freezing of Russian assets from their central bank, $650 billion that are in Western and U.S. banks, this is a disaster for ordinary Russians. So the notion of sanctions as something that can be imposed instead of going to war is simply wrong. It is an act of war, and we should be campaigning against that. That is not something that is a legitimate way to bring about negotiations, to bring about diplomacy in this scenario. One other thing on the sanctions question, sure. There were individual sanctions imposed recently on both Putin, who probably will be affected not at all, because I doubt that he has any assets at this point outside of Russia, but also on Sergei Lavrov, the key Russian negotiator. That's a huge problem, because at whatever point there are serious negotiations that might be close to a conclusion, Lavrov is going to have to be involved in that. And if your top negotiator is under a travel ban and can't leave to go to wherever the negotiations are, or has to wait for some long process before he can safely travel, that's a disaster. That's a disaster. So even some of the individual sanctions can have very broad consequences that are very, very dangerous for people across Russia and across the region.
Well, Phyllis Bennis, we'll have to have you back. And of course, I wish there weren't the need for, but there will be the need to continue this discussion. We have to make sure that diplomacy, not war, becomes more than just a slogan, but an end to the crisis, and how we are to make that so. And thank you for your delving into and ferreting out really some of these questions that trouble the progressive forces, the anti-war forces, and to stimulate us to do what we must, which is really rekindle the movement, a long-term entrenched movement, an anti-imperialist, anti-war movement, because war is not the answer. Phyllis Bennis, fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, where she directs the New Internationalism Project. It's really good always to have you with us, and I encourage all of you to pick up a copy of Host's book, Before and After U.S. Foreign Policy and the War on Terrorism, and then work your way back through her other books. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Mimi. I would also urge people, if you can't get the book, take a look at the article that's in Foreign Policy in Focus last Friday on the crisis in Ukraine.
And your most recent book?
Most recent book is actually the seventh edition of my book, Understanding the Palestinian-Israeli Conflict.
Essential reading. Thanks for mentioning that. And again, thank you for spending time with us and the
thank
work you do.
It's been a pleasure.
Going out with What is War Good For? Edwin Starr. Absolutely nothing. So let's understand the first issue is the cessation of hostilities and bind together in the rekindling of a anti-war, anti-imperialist movement that deals with the proliferation of nuclear weaponry and pushes for what? Equal rights and justice for we, the people of the world.
This has been Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. Educate, agitate, and organize for the empowerment of we the people, for another world is possible.